Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up this week, we'll hear from the Galway student looking to eradicate chemotherapy-induced hair loss. Gavin McLaughlin will be in to discuss the impact of e-commerce on the high street, and we'll meet the man bringing the Masters in Blockchain to Ireland. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you can tweet with hashtag TechTalkNT. But first, I'm joined once again by Sinead McCann of carsireland.ie. Sinead, you're very welcome back to Tech Talk. We're going to talk about something car-related, but in a roundabout way, because Seat have unveiled its first electric scooter, and it's a partnership with Segway. But I don't know much about Seat, the company, so tell me a little bit about them.
So Seat would be like the sporty Spanish end of the Volkswagen Group. So the Volkswagen Group in Ireland actually encompasses four companies. So we have Volkswagen themselves, Audi, Skoda, and Seat. So Seat would traditionally be seen as the kind of the cheaper option of the four, I guess, and also the more stylish, depending on...
The trendy cousin kind of thing.
The trendy cousin, exactly, yeah.
Right.
Now, these cars are all very mechanically similar. So, I mean, the cars, they're built in Germany, but, like I said, it's just a cheaper and sometimes more attractive package. So, for that reason, they have been quite a success story in Ireland, this year in particular. Now, their market share is still quite small. I think they're still at about 3%, but they are one of the few brands that have actually grown this year. In a new car market that has actually declined by about 7% for the year so far, they've actually managed to grow by about the same number, I think, which is pretty impressive. And that's down to they've just had some brilliant product over the last couple of years. They've launched three new SUVs, which have all been very successful. And because they are kind of the better value option of them, they tend to attract a younger and more urban customer base.
Okay.
Which is why I can kind of see they're leaning into things like this. It makes sense.
Yeah. In terms of, like, you say that they're all part of the one family. So this is a bit I don't get about cars. Like, why is one cheaper than the other? Like, why is there such a price disparity between a Seat and an Audi, for example? Is it that the Audi would have all the bells and whistles? Is it that the engineering is better? Like, where does the disparity occur?
It's a very good question. It is a very good question. And it is surprising sometimes how much kind of image and perception comes into how much people will pay for a car, because...
Same with phones. And if it's an Apple phone, you can throw the Apple logo and charge whatever you like.
Exactly. So to be honest, a lot of it does come down to kind of badge and image and that sort of thing, because, you know, I've sat in lots of these cars. They are very similar, even in looks. Like, if you look at, sometimes you look at, especially their more modern SUVs, if you were to put these cars in profile, I think even the most seasoned, and remove the badges, even the most seasoned of modern journalists will struggle to tell you which one is which. So it's just, yeah, it's different, I suppose, different market shares. They're aiming at sort of a different audience each time. Mm-hmm. You know, Volkswagen, they are just a super brand. So, I mean, that's just something that's always going to sell. Audi have the premium aspect. Skoda tend to be more popular in rural areas. And then Seat seems to be taking up the slack there and kind of in urban areas.
So what have been their, like you mentioned there about the SUVs and all the rest. So what are the other standout cars or models from the lineup?
Well, they've also got their classic, the Seat Leon has always been.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that's always been a kind of a great alternative to a Golf. And again, kind of more affordable, very mechanically similar, and, you know, really popular with younger drivers, as is the Seat Ibiza. It's my first car, actually. Absolutely loved that thing. So they would be their other kind of...
And in terms of, like, because they are that little bit more affordable, do they tend to compromise on the tech inside? Because, you know, again, if they're part of the same family as Audi, we know that Audi are more computer than car at the moment. Is Seat in that league as well?
I mean, there will obviously be certain features that are held back for the more premium models. So yeah, there absolutely are more high-tech features that you'll be able to get on an Audi that you can't get on, say, it just yet. But I mean, in terms of the operating system, they're quite similar. It comes from the same base. There might be extra features on the Audi system, but it's still, you know, it's still all generated from the same company. It's very familiar. You will find that if you sat into a Volkswagen, a Skoda or a Seat, the operating system is so familiar.
Okay, so you're still getting, like, good technology within the car.
Excellent technology.
And what are the kind of features? Because we touched upon this before, but, like, what are some of the basic things that, regardless of how much money you're spending, if you buy a 191 or a 192, you're going to get within a car?
Sure. Well, I mean, the latest Seat I actually test drove was the new Turaco, which is their 7-seat SUV. And that, as standard, is coming with some, or, you know, maybe, perhaps maybe midway through the range, is getting some excellent safety features, lane departure warning, you've got active cruise control, which, you know, is available all throughout the range. And in the case of Seat, is available in the kind of lower trim levels. So you're kind of getting more value for your money.
Okay, that's interesting. So were you surprised then when you heard that Seat was sort of dipping its toe into the electric scooter market? Because it's a very trendy thing to do.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's only a couple of weeks ago since they announced their first all-electric car, which is the L-Born, which was revealed a couple of weeks ago. Very, very exciting model. It's going to have a 420-kilometre range and will hopefully be here by next year. Very, very striking car to look at. So you can tell they're going, like all car manufacturers, are on a massive rush to get their electric stuff to market. And something like this, yeah, I suppose it's interesting, but given their customer base and the kind of young and trendy urban appeal, I can see it makes sense. And I think it's great because, I mean, obviously they're a car manufacturer and they're protecting that kind of end of things. But this type of thing makes public transport more accessible to everybody, because there are people where, you know, you can only get so far and, you know, you've got a big old hike then to do it. So,
well, like if you look at somewhere like London where they're trying to keep people out of the city centre, and I think that's something that we should try and look at in Dublin. I know there are plans and whatever, but if you could park your car in, I know Ranelagh's not a great example, but somewhere like Ranelagh, jump on the scooter and then come into town and keep your car out of the city.
Absolutely. And this is, I mean, we're all well aware now since the climate plan last week about the big push towards electrification of vehicles. But I mean, the wider issue is we kind of need to be getting people out of cars altogether, and particularly in the city where it is so congested already. Which is where something like this would just be ideal. And like that example you said, I mean, I would use public transport to get into the city when I'm working, and I'm lucky in that my journey is pretty much end to end. But I used to work up this end of the city, and this was before the X line on the Lewis, which left me with about a 30, 35 minute walk in the morning. Which meant my commute was nearly an hour and a half. Like I might as well have been coming in from Mullingar.
That's so frustrating.
In that case, the scooter would have been ideal. It would have been absolutely ideal.
Yeah, I'd love to hear what you think of these scooters. So this is called the Seat EXS Kick Scooter. And it has a travel range of 25 kilometres and on the one charge. And its maximum recharging time is 3.5 hours. The top speed is 25 kilometres an hour. And it weighs, now it says it weighs just 12.5 kilos. I'm not going to lie. I came back into the office here, I think it was on Tuesday, and it was lying at my desk. And when I say I struggled to pick it up, I mean, I made a noise. It's properly heavy. I couldn't get over it. You know the way I bought a little scooter with my communion money, and like it was a little silver, like very lightweight thing. And I thought it would be the same kind of, no. There's a big L battery in there.
Batteries are heavy.
Who knew?
This is the problem. And this is, you know, even to get that kind of range, like 25 kilometres, I'm sure you could probably ask for a few more, but that would result in a much heavier scooter and kind of, you know.
It's the compromise on the design, I suppose. If you want it to look nice, you can't have a big, huge kind of generator on the back of your scooter.
That's it. But 12 and a half kilos, I agree with you. Depending on how hard you're working in the gym, it's not going to be easy to carry that
around. Or if you're me and you're not going to a gym. I don't think I've been in a gym in a good 6 years. But anyway, I like the idea of it. Do you know the bit that I struggled the most with this? And I've only been using it a little while. Was opening it out.
Right.
So I don't know. Maybe I'm just an idiot. Who knows? But it was folded down. So as in the handlebar was like lying down on the bit that you'd stand on.
Okay.
And it took three of us a good 20 minutes. And then I had to YouTube it. Not ideal. For anyone who has one, what you do is you push down the sort of mudguardy bit over the back wheel. That releases the handlebar and then you can put it up. But it's a gorgeous design. Like it looks beautiful.
You can actually see Seat in the design. You can definitely see the DNA come through.
I was going to say, can you? Because it's a beautiful colour. It's very slick. Everything, the attention to detail is just beautiful. If you haven't seen it, do a quick Google though. So it's the Seat E, the letter E, the letter X, the letter S, Kick Scooter. So you can take a look at it there. It is a thing of beauty. And I'm too scared to go on it in Dublin. I don't care. I'm too scared. If anyone out there, if you've gone on one, do let me know. techtalk@newstalk.com. Would you be tempted to get one?
I would. I don't need it at the moment, but for a position like I was in a couple of years ago where I had that massively long commute and to avoid having to drive in to the city with an empty car, I think it would have been brilliant. I would be just as nervous as you in terms of kind of weaving through traffic and stuff and, you know, am I going to get it taken off me? I know the legislation is a little bit
Well, this is a big issue. Like, No Rock, Fine Gael TD has been banging this drum for a long time because there isn't any real clarity on this, isn't it? And this is something that I've been on to Garda Síochána about as well, because this the scooter that we're talking about now, I think, is €599, right? Which is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And if you go and buy that, the Gardaí, my understanding, and I am willing and open to correction here, but my understanding is that it's at the discretion of the Gard, because the way they break it down is whether or not it's a self-propelled vehicle or not. So if you have to kick to get it off the ground. Now, any scooter, you have to have one foot on the ground when you stand on from a balance point of view. So you could kind of argue the toss in many ways, as far as I understand it. But there is no real clarity. People that I've spoken to who have them don't know whether they should be in cycle lanes. They don't know if they should be on footpaths. They don't know if they should be on the road. There isn't any real guideline as of yet, which is a pain.
Exactly. There needs to be clarity on it, I think, before people can kind of take them up in a widespread way. It's not going to be a problem at the moment because you might see, I don't know, 2 or 3 a day.
Yeah.
But if they were to get more popular, then yeah, there absolutely needs to be legislation to know where you can go and when. And, you know, you obviously don't want anyone to take your new scooter.
I would be
you.
Raging if anyone touched
devastated.
It. That's another part, though. Again, you know, when I was playing around with it the other day, I was like, where can I actually go?
Well, this is the thing. I hope you did get a spin on it.
I did get a spin, and I said every swear word I know. I was so scared the entire time. It's great, though. It's very easy to use. And what's lovely, just from a design point of view, so you have, like, obviously you've got your handlebar, and on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side, you've got 2 little tabs, which are kind of like go and stop. So you're not turning a handlebar. It's not like a motorbike or anything like that. It's literally just a tab that you press, which is lovely. Then you also have the foot brake at the back as well, as you would on a normal scooter. And then there's a teeny tiny little display in between the two handles that'll give you the speed you're going, the distance, battery level, kind of like you'd have on a Fitbit. So you just get that information. You're not going to get distracted by it at all, but it's still good to have that information there. So from a design point of view and a concept point of view, I love the concept of it, but I just don't know if I'd have the guts to go around Dublin City Centre on one.
That's it.
From a stadia point of view, from a safety point of view, and also from a legislative point of view.
But what about the stadia point of view? Do you kind of look at other people on electric scooters and think, what do you like?
No, I look at them and I'm going, I'm so jealous. But I don't know. Maybe I should just care less. Maybe it's just so. Maybe this is turning into a counselling session now. I don't know.
We'll all be on them in 5 years. Who knows?
Do you think that's going to happen, though? Because we spoke about the bike. So Uber wanted to try and bring city bike type thing here, and it was overruled. So I wonder, can you anticipate people going out and buying them, or will, you know, different county councils bring them in, like we have the bikes? What do you think is going to happen?
I think it all depends on the legislation. It all depends on what way we're going to be allowed to use them, whether you're going to be allowed to use the cycle lanes. And I think we just need some clarity on it.
Yeah, if No Rock is listening, Noel,
I mean,
get a wiggle on.
If you release a climate plan like the extreme one that came out last week, and then, you know, something very positive, something very eco-friendly like this comes out, and then, you know, you ban it straight away or make it too difficult for people, then that's a real shame.
Yeah, no, for sure. As I said, I'm dying to know, if you are an owner of a scooter, have you been stopped? Have you had to take it off? Or do you just go about your business and love it? TechTalk@newstalk.com. For those who are wondering why we're talking about this, Sayat, as I said, they've done this partnership with Segway. And the little piece of paper I have in front of me says that Sayat Ireland is offering a free electric EX scooter to those who place an order on any new Sayat model during its open week sales event. Again, I still don't drive, so none of that means anything to me. But if you are in the hunt for a new car, there you go. I guess only time will tell how popular these become. But I do think that case study of having a scooter in the boot, driving to a certain place and then ditching the car is the dream, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is. I think that's where it's going to work best. And I can definitely, I mean, if Sayat are giving them free with their new cars, I can see in July possibly a lot more of them on the road.
Exciting times. Shane McCann of carsireland.ie, thank you so much.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. You may have heard a recent campaign to buy local. And joining me now to talk about the impact technology is having on your local stores is News Talk's Deputy Business Editor, Gavin McLaughlin. Gavin, welcome to Tech Talk. Where should we begin?
Well, look, let's take some recent figures from Visa, who kind of have their finger on the pulse in terms of what's going on with consumer behaviour. There was a 3% fall in face-to-face spending in May of this year compared to the same period last year. And bear in mind that that's taking place in an economy that's performing quite well. So what that tells me, I think, Jess, is that, you know, we're starting to see this trend come to Ireland, where people are increasingly buying their stuff online rather than going down to their local shop and buying it there.
But and I'm going to play devil's advocate here now, because I am a big advocate of going into the shop, and I like touch and feeling and getting something from a shelf. However, the convenience factor it's real. If you don't have to leave your house and you can do, you know, whether it is your weekly shop, whether it is your clothes shop, whether it is, you know, the gift for your mom or your teacher or whatever the hell it is, and you can do it from your couch. Our traditional businesses doing enough to entice people to get off the couch and go into the shop?
I think there's definitely more they could be doing. We might talk about that in a minute. But the first point I'd make is, I mean, what consequence is this going to have for our towns and cities across Ireland in terms of, you know, the businesses that are there on the high street? But even more so, think of shopping centres, right? Because at least if you're a shop that's operating in a city, there's a certain amount of natural footfall that's there anyway. But if you're a shopping centre, you know, it's kind of a destination retail place. You have to make a conscious decision to get up and go and buy whatever product it is you want to buy. They're the ones, I think, that are going to be hit hardest by this trend of people moving away from face-to-face retail. And that opens up a whole question about, well, what's going to happen to these properties? I mean, we're seeing in the States all these stories of mall closures. I suspect we might end up seeing that happening here. And who knows, maybe they could be turned into hotels, leisure destinations. I don't know. But this is going to have big, big consequences for how our physical environment looks around us.
That's a scary thought, because, you know, if we all go down the Amazon model, if every business turns into, you know, a mini Amazon, for example, we could just have warehouses and online storefronts, and that's the height of it.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a very interesting story in the Daily Telegraph this morning, which says that a third of the shops that have closed in Britain over the last while will never open as shops again. So, I mean, what's going to replace them? Is it gyms? Is it hotels? Is it restaurants? Maybe in some cases it'll be housing. But I think in a lot of cases, we'll just be left with vacant units. And that's the kind of thing that really sucks the life out of a town, I think.
Are there certain types of shops? Are there certain industry, types of shops that are closing and that are suffering the most as a result of this trend?
Well, fashion is the one that's being hit in a big way, particularly in the UK. There's just been a wave of fashion store closures over the last little while. And I suppose that makes sense because, you know, a dress or a pair of jeans or whatever, you know, you can buy that online. It comes to you. It doesn't really matter, in a sense, how long it takes to get to you. Obviously, it's maybe more difficult to buy a litre of milk online or, you know, a packet of lettuce, because that's a fresh product. There's a limited shelf life. It's harder maybe to get that delivered. But fashion definitely is the one where it seems to be hitting the most at the moment.
Okay, so is it a direct correlation between, you know, the likes of, you know, the stories that we've seen about, you know, Topshop and Debenhams and all the rest? Is that a direct result of, you know, the likes of ASOS and all the rest, would we say?
Yeah, I think that there's two things going on. One is the increasing migration to online. Two is the British economy is just in a bad place at the moment. And I think that's a big reason why the trend seems to have been so accelerated over there, and why all these closures have been happening so quickly.
It's a grim state of affairs. And so let's go back to the point then, if businesses are, because every business kind of has some form of online presence, whether it is a Facebook page or a Twitter page, not everyone has invested in their e-store. Is it a case of, you know, now is the time to do it, or do you hold your guns but just shout a little bit louder that you still have a shop on the main street?
I think now is the time to do it. But the frightening thing about it, Jess, is that, say, 20 years ago, when people were, you know, going retail shopping, the money was being spent here in Ireland. Now, they're buying their goods from foreign websites. So money that used to be going into the coffers of Irish businesses is now going overseas. You know, these are the shops from where they're getting their jeans or their top or whatever. So that's kind of a scary thought. Unfortunately, I think Irish businesses are a little bit behind the curve when it comes to e-commerce. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try and catch up. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's one of the big frightening things for me is we're just seeing all this money flow out of the country.
Yeah, that's great. Talking of money, fewer and fewer of us are carrying cash anymore. Is that going to impact businesses? Because, you know, if I go into any of the local shops around here in Marconi House, people are either paying with their phone, so with Android or Google Pay or Apple Pay, they're paying with their Fitbit now, or they're doing the contactless on the card. Does that actually impact a business if there's less physical cash?
Well, I think this brings us on to the topic of what can a retail store do to get people in the door? And one of the things really is to improve the experience that people get there. And I think cashless is a good example of how it can do that. It's interesting. It depends on your business, right? Because if you think of it just in pure financial terms, if you don't take cash anymore, you may not need to have kind of the same till infrastructure that you used to have. You may not need to have the same safe infrastructure that you have out the back, the cash transport costs and all that may be taken away. But then on the other side of the coin, you have to do a deal with the bank to process all these extra debit card transactions. So whether you actually save money overall kind of depends on the business, which is quite interesting. But I think it is potentially a way that it can make people's experience a bit better, you know, maybe remove queuing and things like that. That might be the kind of thing that makes people more likely to come and shop in your shop.
Yeah, I noticed the Kaleidoscope Festival, which is taking place this weekend, they have obviously done a deal of some description with AIB, and they're now, you can go and get a wristband. It's like the AIB Tappy, I think it's called. So you can top up a wristband and then you just pay with the wristband. So you're not walking around a festival with cash on you, which I think is a very clever idea.
Yeah, the added security of it is really, really good. The problem can be, though, is I think a lot of people are still a bit put off if they're confronted by a business that has gone totally cashless. Mm-hmm. You know, say, for example, somebody comes in and they want to pay you with a fiver and you say, sorry, I don't take cash. I mean, that's kind of a difficult thing to do. You don't want to have to turn away a sale and you don't want a customer to have a bad experience. So it's very important, I think, to kind of communicate well with people and explain to them what you're doing. Maybe if you're moving cashless, you might have a transition period for a little while where you will still take some cash. But I find it
interesting that the businesses that don't take card.
Yeah, well, it's one of my big bugbears, I have to say, and I have been confronted with it on a couple of occasions recently. It's really, really annoying when someone says, "Actually, we don't take card," and then you have to go and find an ATM or whatever and find cash. So, I mean, there is progress being made, though. I mean, even in cabs now, you're finding that a lot of the cab drivers around Dublin will start to take cards. So there are some businesses that are a little bit behind the curve, but I think eventually they will catch up.
In terms of another point that you made earlier on about the shops, like the fashion shops and other shops like that, right? I've noticed this myself in the last little while, whereby you go into the store to try and buy something on the day and they don't have the stock. I think companies, because of the uncertainty with Brexit and all the rest, people aren't ordering, I don't think, stock in the same capacity, and they're not carrying as much as they would have because of the uncertainty that's happening over there. That, for me, is one of the biggest reasons why I then go and shop online, because I know I can get it.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it is such a tricky thing to manage your stock in the uncertain environment that we're living in now with Brexit and with e-commerce, as you said. I mean, that's the key, though, for these shops going forward is, as we mentioned earlier, the experience, giving people a good experience. You know, God knows what they could do to try and give people a good experience in the shop. Is it that you have virtual reality or something? I don't know, give out free tea and coffee. I mean, this is kind of tinkering around the edges a little bit, but these might be the kind of things you can do to make people's lives a bit easier, to incentivize them to come in. One area where I think shops could help themselves is maybe to tweak their opening hours a little bit, because we are seeing this issue of declining footfall on the streets. Why would you not open up a little bit later and stay open a bit later and maybe try and catch some of the passing traffic that's going to pubs and restaurants in the area? That's maybe one thing businesses could look at. Interestingly, though, when we talk about the changing experience in retail, it's actually Amazon who have done so much damage to physical retail because of what they've done in e-commerce. They are actually putting a few bob into physical retail themselves, and they're working on this cashierless store called Amazon Go. Uh-huh. It's a really cool idea. Basically, you go into the shop and they have this system of cameras and of sensors on the shelves. So your Amazon account is kind of linked up to the store, and it watches to see what do you take off the shelf, and then you can just walk out without having to queue up at a cashier. So, you know, again, it's all about giving people a good experience. Interesting that Amazon, of all people, are maybe the company who could help bring bricks and mortar retail on a bit.
I was in Seattle recently and I went into one of these Amazon Go stores.
How'd you find it?
Weird. You feel like you're stealing. It's very strange. Yeah. And what's the most interesting thing was I saw people walking around the shop trying to trick the system.
Right.
So they were trying to like pick up a bottle of water and then put it back down where the crisps are and then pick something else up. And they were trying to see if the phone would kind of tot it up or if the sensors would get it wrong. And they were baffled by how good the technology was. They weren't getting charged for things just because they're putting them back in the wrong place. It's that sophisticated. So it'd be interesting to see if that does happen. But my concern is we are always maybe 5 years behind the US in terms of like tech trends, right? Like we're only getting on board with podcasting now, whereas the US have kind of been on it for a while. Do you think that given the fact that businesses will shut if they don't get on board, will expedite the process? Or do you think it will be maybe 5 years before we see a positive impact of technology on the retail space?
I'm not even sure we will see that positive impact. I mean, I think it's a cool system that Amazon have. Tesco are looking at it now. But will the net impact be that it kind of keeps bricks and mortar retail alive? I'm not sure that will be. I think, unfortunately, we're bound to see fewer and fewer shops on our high streets. And not even shops. I mean, if you think of bank branches for a minute. Bank branches, of course, you know, such a key part of the economic life of towns and cities around the country. But now we've got this move to online banking and people don't want to go down to the branch anymore. Just from my own personal experience, it's such a pain, I think, if you have to go down to the branch. Mm-hmm. So from a bank's point of view, you know, if they've got fewer and fewer people coming into the branch, why do they need to continue to maintain these expensive buildings across Ireland? So I expect, you know, we could be looking 5 years down the road at a situation where we've got shops closing, we've got bank branches closing, and we're going to have to ask serious questions about how are we going to keep the life in our town centres.
That is a big point of concern. Would that help, though, with the office space crisis that we have? You know, the way, like, you know, people are saying, where are all of our staff going to work when you announce 1,000 new jobs? If we moved the big L banks out of their nice big L buildings, would that help?
Yeah, potentially. And even housing, you know, could some of these buildings be used to help resolve the housing crisis? But I have to say, we do need more offices, but there is a certain sadness that goes with it when you see everything seems to be being turned into an office. The other day I was looking on Twitter a few weeks back and somebody was kind of lamenting the fact that the old Tripod and Crawdaddy nightclub in Dublin had been turned into an office. You know, people have such good memories and now it's kind of this building has joined the corporate gravy train.
It's sold out.
Yeah, it's all out. So, I mean, it is potentially an answer, but it's a bit kind of sad, isn't it?
It is a grim realisation. If your entire city becomes just office blocks.
It's like that episode of The Simpsons where they go into the shopping centre and every unit in the shopping centre has become a Starbucks. I mean, is that kind of the future that we're looking at? And I mean, interestingly enough, coffee shops, they face challenges as well because, you know, with this declining footfall on the streets, people aren't going in for the coffees. It's another sector where we're seeing some challenges too.
Oh, God, you've really brought us down, Gavin.
Well, look, you know, I hate to kill the mood, but you know, you gotta be realistic, I suppose. These are the market forces that are at work at the minute, and whether we can resist them, I'm just not sure.
Okay, I think the key message is if you've got a local shop, just go in, buy something. Just like shop local, basically, right?
Yeah, look, and it is nice to go in and kind of just have a look at the shelves and see what's there. But I mean, I'll give you an example to go back to Amazon. like, I love books, I love to read, but you can buy secondhand books on Amazon for one penny.
Wow.
You know, now obviously there's the shipping cost on top of that, but there's no way that a bookshop can compete with that. Like, so, you know, definitely go out there and support your local businesses. But I think the long-term trend, it's only gone one way.
Right. Well, Gavin McLaughlin, our Deputy Business Editor here on News Talk, thank you so much for that.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. We recently spoke on this programme about blockchain, what it is and why you should care. But would you be tempted to receive a master's in blockchain? Well, listen up if so, because SkillsNet Ireland is offering just that. To find out more, I'm joined by Mark Jordan, the Chief Technologist at SkillsNet Ireland. Mark, just remind us what exactly SkillsNet is.
So SkillsNet Ireland is a national agency. We are operating throughout the country, and our real focus is workforce development. And we achieve that through upskilling and providing lifelong learning opportunities into industry. We connect to over 60 different networks, and through those networks we have connected with over 16,000 different companies. Now, let me just elaborate a little bit on the model and how it works. So we choose networks, and they may have already been in existence, or they may have been created through SkillsNet Ireland. And what those networks are, they have deep roots into their respective industry or geographical locations. They're really well connected. And what that enables them to do is bring industry together, be it through industry bodies or companies within a particular sector. And they bring these companies together, and they have some really productive discussion, mostly around talent, upskilling, future trends, how technology might be changing their businesses. And through that, they then gather requirements. Those requirements are all geared towards what type of training programs can be given. And those requirements are then put into a business case, given to SkillsNet Ireland, who incidentally are funded through the Department of Education and Skills through the National Training Program. So then what we do at SkillsNet Ireland is we sort of verify and validate the business case, make sure it's aligned to government policy. And then we provide funding towards those courses through the networks. The networks then go out and procure the training through different training providers and then offer the training out to the industry as well. Now, this is a really unique model. Now, I myself came from Switzerland recently. I've just moved to the country a month into my new role. And I lived in a place called the Canton or County of Zug. And within that, it's called Crypto Valley because there's so many different cryptocurrency type startups and businesses and blockchain type businesses. And so it's a wealth of talent, and they're great because they're growing, they're expanding, but there's no formal structure for introducing new participants into the industry or upskilling through a third party or anything else. And so that's what I think I've discovered, that the SkillsNet model, SkillsNet Ireland model, is so unique in that it enables that to happen. And what we do is we're able to scale, and we're able to offer courses. Now, traditionally, SkillsNet Ireland have offered sort of the 1 to 5 day training courses, mm-hmm. just the general specific solution solving problems. And more recently, with emerging technologies, the bigger emerging technologies like the Internet of Things, like blockchain, like AI, they've all come to the fore. And what we found is that we've engaged with government, we've engaged with industry, and then the third piece of that is engaging with the higher education institutions. And so in the case of blockchain, which was recently released as a master's program by the Minister Heather Humphreys just a few weeks ago in May, we were able to come together and work very closely with the computing school at DCU, with the industry bodies, with the subject matter experts, and through our Technology Ireland ICT SkillsNet. And they came together and they worked on building the syllabus, creating a program, a modular program for an entire master's program.
And so who is the candidate for this? Because I know you mentioned there about, you know, lifelong learning, upskilling and so on. So if somebody is working in the financial sector already, but they don't know much about, you know, the likes of blockchain and so on, are they the ideal candidate? Is it a recent graduate? Who are you trying to attract here?
Yeah, so really what we're looking for ideally, it's somebody who has a computer science bachelor's, who has been working as an IT professional for a number of years, or a software developer, or indeed their manager, who may be a bit hands-off, but has obviously overall responsibility for the deployment of technology. So those are the classic case studies of the people that we're trying to attract to. We're also, and this is a nice nuance about the program, is that there may be people, and we know there are people who are working in the industry, have great experience, have a lot to offer, but may be suppressed in moving any further because they don't have the strong academic background. Mm-hmm. So perhaps somebody who completed their leaving certificate or dropped out of university and went into the workplace and have built a career and have built a body of knowledge. We are also very open to having those candidates apply, and where previously we'd factor in the academic qualification, we're going to use the experience as a qualification, as a certification for those candidates to be able to apply and participate in the program. One thing about that is that they would have to complete the first two modules, as everyone else would, and then there'd be an evaluation, and then they would, as long as they're successful, they would carry on with the entire program. So the moral of that story is that you don't need to have a bachelor's qualification in order to do a master's program like the blockchain one.
That's fascinating. And to step away from the master's for a moment, because, you know, we've spoken about on this program so many times how fast-paced technology is. And if you are someone who's, you know, two or three decades into their career, you could feel out of your depth, or you could feel that the younger people are coming in and they know more, because it's much more instinctive, I think, and I think that's a fair thing to say. Are there other programs and offerings that they can dip into to get that level of upskilling, just so that they don't feel like it's a completely alien concept?
Yes, there are. And in fact, before our Technology Island ICT SkillNet moved forward with the master's programs, they released a few shorter blockchain-focused programs. And so they're obviously a good way to really dip your toe into the technology, get a feel for it, see if it's something you want to commit to a two-year part-time course on. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of different shorter-term technology training programs and upskilling programs that without going straight into a master's program.
I think that's probably a wise thing to do, particularly if it is a new concept to you. Your role is quite new, and I assume that comes from the demand, because as we said, and you mentioned there, you know, like AI, blockchain and so on. Are there going to be other areas that you're looking to address, and are they all going to be master's, or is it still just, you know, ticking those boxes?
Yeah, so I think what I find with my role, and my role has various different vertical streams, as I like to think about it, one being policy for SkillNet Ireland around the digital economy and the digital transformation. Another is bringing all of our technology SkillNet networks together in a cohesive way so that we're all addressing the same problem, developing the same kind of platforms and solutions and upskilling opportunities. And really the other one is working across the world, working with the EU Commission, working with all the great thought leaders, making sure that from an Ireland perspective, I'm gathering the requirements and the trends and really understanding how to interpret them, as well as working with our government in terms of how we can frankly get more money into digital training, how we can be able to draw down and really promote different training schemes and different programs that again really target the companies that perhaps have been a little suppressed, like the small and medium sized enterprises, and perhaps other sectors where technology hasn't really been at the forefront of their minds and their development strategies, but perhaps now as it becomes more pervasive into their industries, we really want to target those people who are curious about learning, who are curious about the technology and want to know how this technology and how these changes can potentially disrupt the legacy infrastructure and replace the legacy infrastructure they have in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we hear quite a lot that more and more systems are moving to digital systems, cloud-based systems, and that makes perfect sense from a business point of view and a productivity point of view, but not everybody has the same level of digital literacy. So is there the demand to go, and is the demand still there, I suppose, for the back to basics? You know, when I started working here in Newstalk, I think I did, you know, PowerPoint training and Excel training and starting off small and then building into cloud architecture or whatever it is.
Yeah, and definitely, I think the beauty about the SkillNet network program and all of the training programs that reside within the different networks is that there are programs that are almost sort of 101 Excel up to, you know, delivering and deploying blockchain or AI into an infrastructure of a big multinational. So we're very cognizant of the fact that we have a lot of indigenous companies with people that have a real passion to learn. And we have a passion to deliver learning as well. And so we tailor the different courses and make sure that we're funding the right amount of initiatives at the entry level, mm-hmm. as well as at the advanced level.
And so I know you're only just in the door, but how agile is SkillNet Ireland in terms of catering to that demand? So when you go and do your research and something new like blockchain comes along, you know, are you ready and quick enough to turn it around so that come September you have people on the road teaching?
Yeah, and that's the key thing, and that was a real selling point for me. It's a very nimble organization, and we have a structured kind of program that allows the networks to be able to come to us with their business cases, and that's an annual program, but we also have intra-year, and we're expanding that even more. So if a network has demand for a new type of training, they have the opportunity to come to us at any given time, bring it to our attention, and then we have the capability through our network into the Department of Education and Skills to be able to draw down funding or utilize funding that we already have and help them work with them to be able to procure those courses and deliver them to their industry participants. So it's very nimble, and it's a very agile, and we know we need to be, especially around technology, where, you know, if you can't let the grass grow under your feet, and you really must ensure that you're in a position where you can be agile enough to change direction and to add new things and to really understand what the industry is telling you. This starts and ends with industry, and we understand that. So we take all of our direction through our industry participants.
If people want more information, is there one centralized place where they can get all the details?
So for the blockchain masters, all of the information is available on the ictskillnet.ie website. For information generally on SkillNet and the types of SkillNet networks that are available, it's skillnetireland.ie. And I'd recommend everyone goes and looks. There's a lot of training available. There's a lot of information available. And I'm sure there's something that fits the needs.
Awesome stuff. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Now, the 8th Ireland Funds Business Plan competition has awarded the top prize to a 21-year-old Galway student named Aaron Hannan. Aaron was recognised for his work on his second startup called Lily Devices, and he joins me now. Aaron, firstly, what exactly is Lily Devices?
So the idea was established in the BioInnovate program here in NUA Galway, which is a first-in-class program to identify new clinical needs which should be addressed. And so our need was identified through that program, and also we've done a lot of work with patients, in particular those who've been diagnosed with breast cancer, and we've essentially tried to work with them to come up with technologies which solve their needs. And so from that, we've identified that hair loss is a really, really big problem for many people going through chemotherapy. 47% of breast cancer patients consider it the most traumatic aspect of their therapy. So that's really what inspired us to get involved and to make a difference.
And like all good entrepreneurs, there's a personal tie to this as well, from your own life.
Yeah, I suppose, like every family, you know, in Ireland, mine has been touched by tragedy with cancer as well. But I guess for us, the real driving force is meeting patients week on week and wanting to do something to help them. And I think what's really inspiring is that a lot of patients are willing to give their time to improve services for future patients.
So talk to me exactly what the device is, how it works, and the development.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've developed a novel device which is different from existing competitors. So listeners may have heard of something called cold cap, which essentially freezes your scalp and causes your vessels to constrict, and then that stops harmful chemotherapy from reaching your hair follicles. Now, we've developed a new stimulation technique to do this without using cold. So we developed a headband device which can deliver stimulation to deliver the same biological effect, but it does it comfortably and portably. So patients will no longer have to wait in the hospital for hours on end to try and retain their hair. They can do it from the comfort of their home.
That's incredible. And so from a technological and a scientific and a medical point of view, what's gone into to the creation of this?
I mean, there's been hours and hours and months of work that's been gone into this over the past number of months. We've done a lot of benchtop testing here in the Translational Research Facility at NUI Galway. And we've worked clinically with nurses and with patients to try and develop the best solution that we can. And so at the moment, we're currently continuing to iterate and develop our prototypes, and we're hoping to go on to get some in vivo studies in the next couple of months. But there's been a lot of work to get to this point, and it's something that we've really enjoyed, but obviously testing as well.
You have recently been awarded €15,000 from the Ireland Fund's business plan competition. What does that money mean to your research, and where will that go?
I mean, absolutely. The chance to get funding for the project is really, really important for us, and it's giving us that extra accelerating boost to get us closer to market and ultimately to get us impacting patients sooner. And that's the real thing for us. The Ireland Fund's business plan competition was a real help for us because it allowed us to totally focus on who our customer is and understanding the patients and understanding the nurses who work at the coalface every single day, trying to improve services for chemotherapy patients. So it was a really fantastic experience for us. And it kind of pivoted where we saw this technology fitting into the workflow for patients. So it really helps improve our understanding, and ultimately it's going to help us make better patient impact and build a better product.
And so what's the next stage? Like you mentioned there about more research, and obviously given the nature of what it is, that is of a paramount concern. But how long, like, do you see this as having legs, and is it something that could be brought to market before long?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the moment we're pursuing funding from Enterprise Ireland's Commercialisation Fund. Ideally over the next 2 years, we're going to be developing this technology through that fund to try and get it closer to market. So with that fantastic support from Enterprise Ireland, we'll be able to continue to commercialize the idea, continue to do customer discovery, continue to prototype and iterate the technology. And hopefully in the next couple of years, in the next 4 to 5 years, we'll start seeing Lilly devices on the market.
Have you been interacting with the HSE about this? Because I've met the chief innovation officer at the HSE, and they're constantly on the lookout for new ways for healthcare to be delivered to patients.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had some fantastic interaction with staff members from all across Ireland, from many different hospitals, from here in University Hospital Galway, where we're co-located, and also in particular St. James's Hospital in Dublin have been a fantastic support for us. And that's all been facilitated through a new program called the Health Innovation Hub, which is connecting researchers like us and frontline healthcare staff. So we've had some fantastic support from the Irish healthcare system in validating the problem and in helping us start to build a new technology that can make a real difference for patients.
And just tell me a little bit about your own background, because you are studying at NUIG, and I know that you have a co-founder as well. So what are your backgrounds?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're delighted to have a really fantastic team behind us. So I'm joined by my amazing co-founder, Dr. Barbara Oliveira. She's a PhD in electronic engineering. She's currently running a first-in-human study for another breast cancer detection device. So she really knows about breast cancer patients. She knows about the issues that they have. And she's also a technical expert in this domain. So we're really lucky to have her on board. And also, we've also got two fantastic advisors in Dr. Annette Kent and Dr. Martin O'Halloran. Both of them have raised significant capital for West of Ireland spin-outs in the healthcare space. So again, they really, really know what they're talking about. And myself, I founded my first medtech startup when I was 17, I developed a shaving device for my granddad who had severe paralysis, and ultimately built a headset device which could shave automatically for people that had severe paralysis, so shaved by a voice command, etc. So I guess I have a bit of experience in developing medtech ideas from concept into prototype and into early stage commercialization. I'm lucky to be an alumnus of the Trinity College Launchbox program as well. So this is my second startup. Things are faring out quite well, and we really hope that as a team we can make a big impact for patients.
Well, the company is called Lilly Devices, and there's no denying that it's an incredible mission, and it must be quite rewarding, I'm sure, to be working on something that would have such an impact on people who are going through chemotherapy. So fingers crossed it does come to market before long. But for the moment, Aaron Hannan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Jess.
And that is all we have time for this week. If you missed any of the programme, you can listen back in full on newstalk.com. But don't forget to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, Pocket Casts, or Go Loud. Patrick Egan is up next here on Newstalk. I'll chat to you next week.